Welcome to the Weekly Leadership Experience, a place for leaders to get inspired, be challenged, and grow. I am your host, Rashad Oberlander. Let's get started. Today's episode of the Weekly Leadership Experience is brought to you by my 7-day Leadership Growth Challenge. It's a free challenge that I've created, and it's delivered by email over the course of 7 days. I've created 7 compelling questions to challenge various aspects of your leadership, the way you lead, and why you lead. Go to rashadoberlander.com and scroll down until you find the 7-day leadership challenge, or look for the link in the show notes. And now, on with the show. Hello, leaders, and welcome to this week's show. I'm joined today by Cody Royal, author of Where Others Won't. He's host of the Where Others Won't podcast and is managing partner of NTSQ Sports Group. Cody is also head coach of AFL Team Canada. Cody draws on his extensive sporting background to bring wisdom and insight into people innovation from the locker room into the boardroom. Cody, I'm so proud to have you. Welcome to the show.
Absolutely delighted to be here, mate. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really cool. So as listeners can pick up right away, you've got an Australian accent. Tell us a little bit about your background and how an Aussie rules footballer ends up in Toronto, Canada.
Yes, I wasn't necessarily intending on staying here for longer than a couple of years that I wanted to get some work experience overseas. Had an opportunity when I was 25 to do some traveling, and the initial ideal destination was Chicago, but I looked at everywhere from Amsterdam to Mumbai, Hong Kong, Dubai, Johannesburg. It didn't really matter to me. I wanted to go leave the island of Australia and go internationally, and ended up in Toronto. And then, yeah, here I am 11 years later, still here. Never moved home. But my background was Aussie rules football. I played at a high level back in Australia, in Melbourne, which for those who don't know, there's probably 3 sports that I can think of that are at this level of religion. And it's soccer in England and Brazil. It's hockey in Canada, and it's Aussie rules in Melbourne. And I was immersed in that from a young age and almost went professional. Missed out on that, and then that's kind of led me down this path. And so, you know, we can talk a little bit more about that, but yeah, it was kind of this, you know, 25-year-old kid that wanted to go and do something else and ended up in North America and have been here ever since.
And you found love here and everything like that too, which is really cool.
Yeah, I met my wife in Toronto, and she's Irish, so we're both immigrants here, and very happy. So, we kind of dismiss things very easily in North America. We're talking, on the back end of the US election, and, a lot of people come to me and say, you know, why would you move to North America and all these kind of things. But some perspective, this is a great country in Canada, a great continent in North America. There's so much to see and do, and the scale of things here and the scale of business and the scale of politics and the scale of sport shouldn't be lost on people. It's the envy of the world still, regardless of what's going on. So, yeah, I'm delighted and I love it here, and so does my wife.
Yeah, awesome. Well, and, you know, for some of the listeners, they might recognize a little bit of similarity in our story, you know, having been from Australia from myself, and I moved here a little younger than you were. And I was, you know, just after my 22nd birthday. And so I've been here, you know, 14 years. And, I met my wife before moving here, but we married. And the intention was to go back to Australia. But we love it here and can't be happier. Mm-hmm. So that's cool. So, listen, your book is a really great read. For anyone that hasn't read it or hasn't heard of it, I encourage you to check it out. It's Where Others Won't. You can find it on Amazon. But it's a book about finding wisdom in sports and applying it to business and leadership. Cody, what drove you to write this book?
It was almost a perfect storm, to be honest with you, Rashad. Like, the you know, kind of coming from my sports background and then getting into coaching quite young, and then also having a corporate career at the same time. So, you know, I came from an HR background, ended up in recruiting here in Toronto. So literally Monday to Friday was building teams for companies. Saturday and Sunday was trying to build the high-performing national program of Aussie Rules Football. And so I was just spending all my days thinking about how to build teams and looking at those comparisons and observing how they did it in corporate and trying to learn from, you know, the other elite coaches and the other elite sports in Canada here. And that was really the catalyst for writing it, was just living in it day in, day out. And what I realized was that in the corporate world, we get it wrong in terms of how we assess sports and its relevance to the business world. We tend to just default to motivation as the category that we go to. Like, let's get the quarterback in, let's get Connor McDavid in, and you know, you can talk about motivation and we'll put him up on stage and, you know, you'll give a rousing speech and all our staff will be motivated. And it's just not that. You know, it's the way I positioned it is the relevance for us in business is that professional sports has essentially had 150 years of quality testing, team building, and talent optimization strategies and team optimization strategies that we just haven't had the practice in the business world. So we've got this body of knowledge sitting in sports. How do you recruit? How do you lead? How do you build culture? Because that's all they've really had in sport for 150 years. And so there's been a lot of ideas flow through there that we can actually look at and harness. And we just, I guess we pay attention to the wrong things is what I'm saying. And really, I just tried to point that out to people with the book.
Yeah. And it is something that you tackle throughout the book, you know, the misconception that there's no overlap between sports and business. I'm really interested in your perspective on why that's actually not true.
Well, I mean, the funny thing was, and this is why I think the book has had a little bit of success, is there was a timeliness to it. And I think the business world has really just realized that people are their competitive advantage. And so, yeah, I think there was a timeliness with coming into that realm, because we've spent the last couple of centuries in business, and as, you know, corporations have come to the fore, there's always been something else. There's always been innovation, or there's always been a faster supply chain, or there's always been all these other things that you could do before taking care of people. And then, you know, probably it's not that long ago, really. It's like 2016, 2017 is when we started to sit up and go, oh, shit. You know, our people are actually our X factor. You know, pretty much everything else has been commoditized. And yeah, that's why it seemed like a topic that I wanted to write about. It was just coming into popularity. I've just been in so many situations, you know, speaking engagements and standing on stage, and people just challenge that there's any link between sport and business. People just don't believe in it. They just think, again, going back to that motivation, they just think that to win the Stanley Cup, the coach just walks in at the start of the year and slaps a picture of the Stanley Cup up on the wall and says, that's where we're going, lads. And everyone's just motivated for 82 games plus the playoffs, right? Like, that's what outsiders sometimes think. So I'm just trying to say, look, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a sports fan. There are lessons here, and there's this huge body of knowledge that we can learn from. And you better learn fast, because your opponents in the business world are going to figure this out if they already haven't.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I personally, like, as far as my style of learning and communicating is I love analogies, and I love finding, you know, lessons in different things. And, you know, sports to me has always been something where you can learn a lot. And it's not just like, what's your favorite quote from Vince Lombardi or one of these really famous people who are quoted all the time about motivation or leadership or what have you, but there's actually lots to learn. So I really love what you've done with the book and the stories that you tell. there's 53 ideas that you've identified and illustrated, each with a story. Do you have any personal favorites in the book?
Yeah, I do. And I mean, there's a lot. And what I'm actually really curious about is the people that have read it and what they took away from it. So can I spin that? I'll answer the question, but can I spin it around on you? What were the ones that, what stood out to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, one of my other questions and thoughts that I was going to come up with here for you was a couple of areas that really resonated with me. One was the chapter on, you know, experience not always being equal to leadership.
Yeah.
And, you know, how you gave a few different stories in there about how teams looked to other, you know, other sport categories and looked at, you know, someone in hockey looked at someone in baseball, or baseball looked at someone in soccer, and, you know, were able to bring a different set of skill set, but they brought a completely different perspective to the team. And a lot of times experienced great success with it. So I really enjoyed that chapter. And then, you know, as something that was really quite interesting, I thought, was your story about the Stoke City Football Club. Mm-hmm. And that story tells kind of the story of this, of the soccer team there. It's a soccer team, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, they're tough to beat, but they're not the elite team in the league, right? Like, but they're happy with kind of maintaining that performance. They're not hell-bent on winning, but they actually have a fairly consistent track record of kind of being in that, in the middle of the pack, and they hold that territory very strongly. So I thought that was also a very interesting story, you know, specifically. So those were kind of some of the takeaways that I enjoyed from your book.
Nice. Mm-hmm. I love that. I don't get that one a lot, so I'm glad you picked up on Stoke. Not long after I published that, they got relegated. So they actually deviated from the system or the plan that I talked about in the book, and it's ended up costing them. And it's funny because they actually came out and talked about it. The chairman, after they got relegated back into the second tier of English football, actually came out and kind of apologized to the fans and said, we made some mistakes and got away from our core identity. And I guess that kind of validates what I was talking about, in that, you know, they flinched in that, you know, they had spent, and so for people that don't know, you know, Stoke City, the football club are called the Potters. It's like this industrial area in Britain, and they played in the Premier League for about 11 years, and they basically finished between 8th and 12th every single year. And so it's an interesting story because, again, we tend to think about sports in North America and we think, you know, there's only winning. You either win or you don't. And what becomes really interesting in sports like soccer is where, you know, out of a league of 20 teams, like, how do you keep a team together and motivated and, you know, have ambitious players come together to finish 11th and that still be okay and that still actually be a win for your club? I think that's really interesting from a leadership perspective, and there's so much relevance to business there, like we talked about. But yeah, I mean, they got away from that strategy and it's cost them quite dearly, and, you know, they've plummeted down the leagues because of it. And then to answer your question, some of my favorites were, yeah, definitely the one that really resonated with me the most is around experience, which you noted as well. And how I think we need to do a much better job of identifying leaders at a younger age. I really don't like the model in business that we have that's very hierarchical, that's very tenure-based, that you basically come into the system at 22 after you've finished your degree, and then you basically have to work for 15 years to earn the right to become a leader or a manager. There's a whole range of different reasons that's wrong, in that you've basically built your resume on doing tasks well is one, and leadership relies on none of those tasks. You're actually tasked with setting people up for success rather than doing the task itself. Second to that, and I didn't write about this, but I found out subsequently, I went and looked up the average age of the first manager in the United States. I think it's 35. And the average age that someone, maybe earlier, 33, the average age of the first, having your first child is actually exactly the same. And so there are things like that that we can look at and say, you're basically, you're becoming a leader at the same time that you're trying to learn how to be a parent. So you're trying to learn those two things at the same time during your career. And to be a great leader, you kind of got to be there a lot of the time for your staff. And to be a great parent, you've also got to be there a lot of the time for your kid. And whether you can do those two things at the same time, I'm not so sure. I don't necessarily think that, you know, it's not 100% one way or the other, but I just think there can be better pathways. And, you know, we're starting to see more and more examples of young leaders coming through in the workplace in their 20s. I wrote a lot about young coaches who are in their 20s and early 30s who are coaching even players that are older than them, that are, you know, coaching at the highest levels in the NFL, in the you know, in the Premier League, in the Champions League, over in Europe in soccer, and not being overawed. And so that's what I mean. Like, we need different pathways, and not just this tenure-based model that we've had. Mm-hmm. And then the other one, again, just to kind of go from a, well, it's a little bit Canadian, but a little bit soccer-based, was Ralph Kruger was really my favorite. And if you don't know Ralph, he was the coach of the Edmonton Oilers. He's now the coach of the Buffalo Sabres, but spent quite a few years as the chairman of Southampton Football Club in the Premier League. And so, you know, the one is when you look at it, how the hell does a hockey coach run a Premier League team is the first question. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a lifelong ice hockey coach who coached Switzerland for 12 years, finally got a chance in the NHL, you know, fired after, I think, the lockout shortened season in the NHL, and then ends up winning a gold medal with Canada and then jumping on a plane and running a Premier League team. But what was really what was really interesting was I asked him, what do you do differently now that you're the chairman? And he said, nothing. He said, I come to work and I coach every day. I don't coach hockey players anymore, but I walk in here and I coach people and talk to people and listen to them. And my job is exactly the same. And that's really the core idea of what I'm trying to get at with all my content, really, is that we're talking about human beings and we're talking about leading humans and what they need. And that's just such a great example of, it doesn't matter if you're coaching hockey players in the NHL or you're not even attached to the team, you're actually on the business side as the chairman of a Premier League team. He saw it as doing exactly the same job. Like, that's just the perfect picture. I couldn't paint it any better myself if I tried.
Yeah. No, I love those stories. I mean, I think, you know, like you say, Ralph Kruger is a good example of that, you know, kind of transition between different disciplines and how the person can be successful regardless of that kind of varying experience. And then, you know, obviously I could talk for a while, I think, about, you know, that whole chapter that you're going over as well, about experience not equaling leadership. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. You know, that shift that you're talking about in the last few years, I think you're absolutely right on. And, you know, I see all the time just more and more people talking about wanting to change how, you know, like, how do we recruit and how do we train and how do we develop people? So I think that shift is important, and I think that it's very real. But a lot of people just kind of want to bog down in the old ways, maybe. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is the largest resistance to change that we'll probably see, because it's hard. Like, this is the hardest thing business will ever have to do, is care about their people. Everything else is pretty easy, like figuring out whether you get a spot on the end cap for your product at the supermarket, or, you know, whatever it is, the four P's or whatever of marketing, or, you know, innovation, or, you know, trying to some sort of competitive strategy, finance, blah, 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 blah. That's all easy because you can manipulate those things really quickly, like figures and numbers and you know, coming up with new ideas and you know, building products. It can all be done relatively easily. But when you're tasked with, you know, Ryan Hawke told me this great example. And if you haven't listened to Ryan's podcast, I highly recommend it, The Learning Leader. And Ryan came on my show and he told me this example of his first day as a manager. And he had this woman on his team who was going through a divorce, and she shows up crying in his office on like his first day. And this is what I mean, is that it's hard. Like, you're not dealing with business propositions when you've got Sandra on the seat opposite your desk, telling you about how she's going through a divorce and she's struggling personally. Like, this is what I'm. It's really, really hard. Like, people are hard work, and that's why there's so much resistance to change, is because people don't want to deal with that. But the ones that do are the ones that are going to get ahead, and the ones that are the ones that they're already getting ahead. And more people, more and more great, talented staff are going to gravitate towards those people and those companies because they're cared for and they're taken care of. And there's going to be a lot more resistance before we're done here, man. Like, there's going to be a lot of people just want to go back to the old way that was easy. And I understand that, but yeah, it's not going to fly.
It's interesting because I think that, like what you're saying, like, it's totally true. And I mean, there's a few different people I can think of off the top of my head that are talking about the, you know, work-life balance is actually the wrong idea. It's work-life integration, and how there's a, you know, you can't just show up to work and drop the rest of your life at the door. Like, we're not robotic in that sense that we can just leave everything at the door, and then vice versa, when we leave work and go home, we can't just drop everything from the day and walk in and just be family man or family woman right away. And so there's kind of integrating work is one thing. And then the other thing is that, you know, there's this almost mockery, I think, of people that are kind of going against the grain with some of their ideas. I'm thinking of Dan Price, for example, from Silicon Valley, who decided that he was going to pay everyone in his company $70,000 a year as the base salary. And I mean, this is still kind of an ongoing story with him because he's rolling it out over a little bit of time and getting everybody up to that rate and whatever. But, you know, there's a group of people who are lauding him as a hero, and there's a group of people who are mocking him and basically calling him a lunatic and doesn't know anything about business. And so it just sort of seems like there's these two camps at war trying to figure out who's actually going to prove the model right or wrong, I guess. Like, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, here's the way that I think about it. This is kind of the way that I think about a lot of things, in that all that really matters is whether it works for Dan and his company. And this is what I tell a lot of coaches as well. I'm fortunate in that I get to speak to a lot of coaches at, you know, elite levels of sport, and there's so many things swirling around about, like, you have to do this and you have to have this, you know, strength and conditioning thing and sports science thing, and you have to have this analytics and you have to have that. And the reality is, you don't have to have any of it. And you just have to do what's right for your team at that time. And it's exactly the same in companies. Like, part of the reality that we forget about business is there's really no such thing as competition. In that, what I mean by that is ultimately we get to decide who we think we're competing against. Like there's actually no rules really, other than maybe some governance structures. But again, if I'm a bank and I want to think that I compete against Apple, that's all I need to think, is that I compete against Apple. And, there's all these structures that are kind of just in our head that don't really matter to anything or anyone. And so, Dan Price's salary structure and his way of building teams and sacrificing, his $300,000 salary to make the exact same as the person that walks in the door on their first day, it only needs to work for them. Who cares what other people think and the way other people have built their businesses? That's the great thing about business, is there's no one way to do it. And, you can try different things, and I'm sure he'll find things that he didn't anticipate and iterate on those. But I have so much admiration for him. And we've sent a couple of messages back and forward. But I have so much admiration for him for not only doing it, but putting his hand up and talking about it and, validating that it can be done. And that creates a doorway for others to walk through and say, we're going to do something similar for our business as well, because, we like that idea, or we think that's right, or we think that's the right way to do business. That's all that really matters.
Mm. And if I'm hearing you right, like it's sort of that, you don't have to do what someone else is doing, but as much as you demonstrate in your book, but there's ideas out there that people can emulate because it makes sense and it's the right thing to do, and something similar will work for them.
Yeah, we get so stuck on what everyone else is doing, but it's not about having what everyone else has. It's about having what you have, just better. And we spend so much time analyzing competition, and again, like it's completely arbitrary in most cases, and it can become stifling, spending so much time worrying about what the other guys are doing rather than just working, being internal facing and saying, what do we need? What do we need? What do our people need? And this is going to be the big change for people, is that model that I was talking about earlier, where you're kind of outward facing, you're looking at the market. Where can we innovate? Where can we drop our price? What's our marketing look like? Those are all outward facing activities from a business. I'm saying face inwards. What do our people need? If our people are talented and they come up with good ideas, like the marketing strategies and the innovation strategies are all internal anyway. Like you have them, that's literally what the company is a set of brains that are working to solve those problems. So if you start to foster that environment, you're going to hit those external metrics anyway, but you have to turn around and face internally rather than looking out at what the competitive landscape is. It's the same in sport as it is in business. Like the teams that are so petrified of playing the Golden State Warriors or playing the New England Patriots or whatever, they're going to lose straight away because they're petrified and they've spent all this time, rather than saying, okay, that's great, Steph Curry and Klay Thompson can nail threes, but what can we do? So how can we try to nullify what they do, but do what we do better? And that's what I'm saying. It's not about having what they have. It's about having what you have, just better.
I like that. I like it a lot. In your experience, in what you're talking about, when you're on stage or you're coaching some clients through innovation or people strategy and stuff like that, like what do you teach people about how they can begin to think differently in their business? How can they get started doing something different?
Yeah, I'd say the first thing that just doesn't equate to a lot of people is to ask. And what I mean by that is like ask questions. You sit in some meetings with these people, decision makers or managers, new managers or even coaches, and they rush to this thing, you know, like Sandra won't do this because, you know, she's never done it before. Let's just use that as an example. And the question becomes, well, did you ask Sandra? So you can rush to this, well, you know, she won't do that because her behavior has suggested that she won't do that in the past, or she's been grumpy, or blah, 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 blah. And again, Sandra doesn't exist. I've just picked a name out of a hat. And the question stands up time and time again, like, did you ask? Did you ask this person? The same goes for people that, you know, are late to work. Like, did you, rather than sitting there and being like, geez, you're 15 minutes late, did you ask why? Like, does that person, you know, are they dropping their child off at school and then they have to catch a bus? Like, have you asked? Have you taken the time to care enough to ask rather than just put a label on someone and kind of go in with negative intent? People, for the most part, don't do things to mess up. They're trying to do their best 99% of times. There's actually positive intent. There's your 1% where people steal and people do this and they step outside the boundaries and they do things maliciously. But those are actually really, really rare when you start to dig into them. And so that's why this is such just an interesting question as a way to start, is like, did you ask? Did you ask the person? Did you ask the person that told you to go off rather than disciplining them? Like, did you ask why? The chances are it wasn't about you, right? Like, chances are something else is going on in their life. They're under stress somewhere else. And you can take that away from them just by asking whether they're okay. It's not a natural thing to do because we want to rush to, you know, this person has whatever behavioral problems, or they're not a good employee, or they're blah, 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 blah. But this is what I'm getting at with organizations that care more, is it's probably not about you. This person's probably having a hard time in some other area of their life. You've just worn the butt of them telling you to F off in the office, which is, you know, not great. But if you take the time to say, like, are you doing okay? That's, you know, a bit out of character for you. Can we help in any way? That's such a game changer of a way out of that scenario, rather than just disciplining them and going in thinking there's negative intent behind that.
Mm-hmm.
So did you ask? Is where you can start to answer your question. Mm-hmm. Don't ask people things. Ask them.
Yeah. Well, and in my mind, I sort of thought you might have something that was really, you know, a process and stuff like this. But no, I mean, it is so simple, but it is so true and not easy. Very counterintuitive, I think, to a lot of, you know, the normal way of doing business and running your team.
Yeah. I mean, look, again, kind of going back to the last question as well, is I'm really not a big like template and process kind of person. Like, even, I mean, you've read my book, there's no answers or templates or anything in there. There's no reflection points really for anyone. It's like, look, go and think about these things and figure out how they work in your environment. And so because of the contextual nature of business and sport and everything that we go through, I actually shy away from particularly people who write about or come with this like fully formed, you know, x-axis, y-axis, you're trying to move people from this to that. I really don't believe in that kind of stuff because it doesn't fit every environment. And I think it's better to give people the questions to reflect on and to think about. And that's why I answered the way I did, is like, that's just a question. Every single person, every single manager, leader can go and ask someone that works for them, like go and ask a question of someone that works for them. That's foolproof. But if I gave you a Myers-Briggs, you know, your red person, yellow person, green person, blue person kind of thing, like that's you've just made them into something that they're not, right? Like, someone's not a color, they're a human being. and they should be treated that way, not as, oh, they're red, so they get angry all the time. if you want a shortcut to pissing off people who have some anger issues, call them red. I'm probably in that category, as why I can speak from experience. But you know, I'm really cautious of those kind of things. But again, really, really simple. Everyone, like, did you ask? Go and ask someone. Are you doing okay? Or can I help you? Or yeah, hey, you were late. Like, can we talk about that? I want to make sure that you're okay. Way better outcomes.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, like I said, the simplicity of it is beautiful, because it doesn't take, you don't have to be, you know, a genius or anything to be able to implement. Just ask. Like, you just have to ask and ask what's going on and find out why is this happening. And you can just asking the question is so simple. And, you know, I like that. So that's really cool. You know, one of the things that you mentioned in the book, and it doesn't segue very nicely from what we've been talking about, but I am curious. You mentioned like your personal career in Aussie Rules being affected a lot by analysis by paralysis, right? And mm-hmm. So the answer you've just given me is so very simple. So just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So like I kind of said at the start, you know, I played at a reasonably high level, particularly in juniors. So I was in the Victorian squad, which is like the provincial squad at under 15s, under 16s and under 18s, and then didn't get drafted. So for Canadians, that's essentially the equivalent of, you know, playing in the Canada-Russia series for Ontario or Quebec or the W, and then not getting drafted out of that. So that's the kind of level that I was at, and essentially capitulated from there. And most of my problems were just from overthinking as an athlete and almost thinking too much like a coach, and not really, I wasn't able to get into any flow state, is how we would describe it now. Those words didn't exist back then. This is, you know, 2002. But yeah, I just didn't have an off button, and I was always just thinking about the game and, you know, intimidated by the players that I was playing on. I thought they were a lot better than me, even though clearly the evidence was suggesting that, you know, I was at that level as well. And it just ended up strangulating my career. I started hating the game and essentially dropped out of playing at, I think, at the age of 23, and I got into coaching at 24. I took a year off. It was this analysis paralysis where I couldn't slow my mind down. I couldn't just get into the flow of the game. I couldn't get into any sort of flow state where things were just happening. And then I would start to get frustrated, and then I wouldn't perform well at all. And it's probably what makes me a reasonable coach, ironically. But I really struggled with that, and have had to kind of navigate through that just in general in life, subsequently as well. So there's probably a lot of people that might resonate with as well, that they analyze things really deeply and you know, struggle to almost quote unquote dumb it down a little bit and just kind of live and be in a moment and find some sort of flow. Mm-hmm. The more I talk about it, the more I speak to other people about it, the more people respond with, "Oh my God, me too."
But, oh, totally. Yeah, and I mean,
I certainly had a massive case of it.
Yeah. Well, and I'm absolutely, have been and still am in a lot of cases an overthinker, and kind of get really bogged down in some things, and other things I'm a little bit more free with, but you know, I totally get that. But I like that you point out too, that it actually is one of the things that make you a good coach. You know, what's not always good in one area is actually probably, useful in another way.
Yeah, and you can find ways to navigate it. Like, I mean, geez, launching a podcast and writing a book and all these different, moving internationally, like these aren't things that are, you know, come naturally to me necessarily. And they generate a lot of fear because of that analysis. You know, you kind of sit there as you're about to hit go on a podcast and you're like, yeah, man, like this could bomb, and all those thoughts go through your head. And I don't think that ever goes away, but you can kind of, I've learned to force myself into some of those situations to really keep pushing myself and challenging. But those are a lot more comfortable for me than when I was growing up and athletically, and, you know, there was no kind of outlet to be able to do that when I was younger. So, yeah, like I don't think it ever goes away, but you can certainly find avenues for you to try to push yourself in as well.
Last couple of questions for you, Cody, before we wrap up. I like to ask every guest on my show these two questions. What is one thing you know about life or leadership that you wish everyone knew?
That's a good one. There's a lot, and I'm trying to be on a journey to tell some of those stories, and I'm drawing this out to give myself more time to think.
No worries.
But I'm going to go with, we should write a blog. We should collaborate on a blog about this. There's probably a 10,000 word essay on what everyone should know about leadership or life. Mm-hmm. My answer is going to be, and only because I've been writing my second book about this topic, is that leadership stems from self, and what we have done a very bad job of previously, and this goes especially for sports coaches, but I'd say CEOs and people in high pressure situations, you know, elite performers, is that we've never taken care of ourselves. And what's ironic, particularly in sport, is that the head coaches are the ones that are tasked with understanding human performance at its absolute optimum, and then listen to none of those recommendations. they take none of that advice. If you think about an NFL coach, they know the importance of sleep, but they don't sleep. They know the importance of nutrition, even on their brain, and they give all those sheets to the players, and we're on a road trip to Atlanta this weekend, and this is how we're going to eat to make sure we're at our optimum. And then the coaches drive through the McDonald's drive-through and get a 10-pack of nuggets each. You can keep going down that chain, alcohol, sleep, just identity and getting wrapped up in your own identity and dealing with trauma. Like all these things bubble through in your coaching and in your leadership. And the reason I'm talking about this is because what happens with leaders, we don't talk about this enough, is as a leader, you create yourself in your team. I'll say that again. Like as a leader, you create yourself in your team. So if you haven't looked after yourself, there's no self-care, if your personal life's in disarray, if you've got problems with substances, if you've, all these different facets that go into being a human being, and they're all tough. But leadership stems from you and how you perceive the world. And so, if you haven't dealt with that stuff, it's going to come out on your team. And so, yeah, I've been writing about that. And I think it's something that everyone should know about in life and in leadership in general, because we're in a shifting leadership space and a shifting society in general as humans. And so we should be talking about this more regularly. We need to deal with the gremlins that we have rather than keep pushing them down.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that that's a really insightful answer, Cody. And, you know, I think as a dad, as a parent, and I think people who are listening who are parents can probably go, oh yeah, you know what? Like, I know that my kids learn the language that I use and the things that I do and the behaviors and actions that I do. And then we go to work and we behave in ways that we probably wouldn't always want our kids to behave. And it's kind of an interesting dichotomy that we kind of separate those two worlds, but there's a lot of similarity actually in that way where, you know, our kids learn everything that we do. And sometimes it comes back and bites you when, you know, your kid says something, you're like, oh yeah, I do say that. I should probably stop saying that. So I really appreciate your answer from that perspective myself. Final question, Cody, when it's all said and done, what three words do you want to be used to describe your life?
Ooh.
It's another tough one.
Yeah. The first one would be reliable. I value reliability probably more than any other, you know, human behavior. And mm-hmm. what I mean by that is literally everything from the way that I coach my team, I ask them to be reliable. And it's not just showing up on time. It's, you know, talking to their teammates and being in the right positions on the field. And then it stems into my life as well. You know, friends that are reliable, I want to be reliable. So that would be the first one. I would say a little bit similar, but trustworthy as well. And then I want to say something about, this is annoying because I'm a writer by trade, and so coming up with words should be the easy one, but when it's about you, it's tough. I love this question, but I'm totally stealing this for my show, by the way.
Awesome. So, love it.
So I'd like to be renowned as someone who, I guess you could just say a leader, but really like push the barrel of leadership and push the conversations forward. But I'll bundle that under a leader in that, and I'll explain this one because it ties a little bit back to identity that we're talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we need more people to be proud to identify as leaders. And what that means is, for me at least, and I kind of like this description, is that doesn't mean you're always in power. It doesn't mean you're always the decision maker or the top of the hierarchy to be a leader. What it means is that you play the role that you're best suited to in any given situation. And so you can be a leader regardless of who you are, and you might not actually lead in 9 out of 10 situations in your life, but in that one that you do lead, you'll excel at that. And then in the other 9, you'll play your role because you're happy to play your role. And so, yeah, it's funny because I've toyed with answering questions. Like when someone says, what do you do? I just want to say, I'm a leader, to not give them the answer they want, because they want to hear accountant or right, like they want a bucket, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what they're thinking about. Like, what bucket can I put you in? But I know if you answer with leader, one, that's how I want to be identified. But then two is it doesn't lead to the answer that they want, which is kind of makes me happy. But yeah, so what did I say? Reliable, trustworthy, and leader. It's a long way of answering your very simple question. Rashad.
No, very cool. I enjoy the description behind it, and most of my guests do usually give me an answer like that where they describe the words. So that is cool, and I like the words that you've chosen. Awesome to have you on the show. Really appreciate your time today. I know you've got a book coming out again soon, but where do you want people to go to connect with what you're doing and learn more about where others won't?
Yeah, the easiest places to find me are just at codyroyal.com. And everything from podcast to book to other blogs to other things that I've done along the way, coaching, links to our games, all that kind of stuff. So housed there in one central place. But the easiest way to talk to me is on Twitter or LinkedIn, actually. Twitter or LinkedIn. And with a name like Cody Royal, there aren't really any of me, so I'm very easy to find, as I'm sure you are.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure there's...
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure those links are there for you all listening. Go to RashadOberlander.com and find the episode today with Cody Royal. You can connect with him there. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Cody, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Rashad. Appreciate you asking me on.
If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, would you head over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and subscribe, leave me a rating, leave me a review, and share this with a friend. It spreads the word and helps the podcast grow. You can also find me on social media at R.E. Oberlander. Until next time, stay awesome.